Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Happy holidays, everyone. We hope you're having a safe and healthy week.
And maybe watching some basketball. The NBA season tipped off this week in empty arenas across the country, so we thought it would be a good time to revisit one of our favorite interviews of the year.
That's right. We had fun with this one. You might know our guest from ESPN's Last Dance documentary, or maybe just as head coach of the Golden State Warriors. We're talking about eight-time NBA champion Steve Kerr.
That's right. Basketball, politics, international affairs. We talked about it all with a guy who's had such a remarkable life and career.
And when we spoke, it was a strange time for both Kerr and the Warriors. It was August. The team was basically shut down at home, watching other NBA teams compete in the league's bubble in Orlando.
Yeah, they were part of the Delete Eight, as he said. And we really didn't know if or when this season was actually going to start. So we started by asking Kerr what life was like for him and the Warriors after the season was suspended back in March.
It was really strange, when the suspension happened. It all seemed to happen pretty quickly. Although I have to tell you, my son, who got a degree in public health from Berkeley, was telling me about it in January. And he kept saying, this is a really big deal. And I'm like, nah, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And he said, no, I'm serious. I had to take two classes on epidemics or pandemics, and this could be really bad. And so when the suspension happened, we kind of looked at each other and
over Zoom.
Yeah, exactly. And then I thought, okay, well, a few weeks and we'll be back at it. And yet we're still out, still waiting for life to resume to normal.
How are you guys like coping with that as a team? I mean, are you trying to stay connected virtually? I know there's been some maybe casual practicing, but especially at the beginning, I mean, is that something you're worried about, is like losing that cohesion?
Well, yeah, we're worried about it, but there's not a whole lot we can do about it. You know, we're one of the eight teams. We have been referred to as the Delete Eight by many people. There's 22 teams in Orlando playing in the bubble and eight of us who were not invited. So the Delete Eight is, we're all sitting at home watching everybody else play, but we are not technically allowed to practice other than just individual workouts for players. So we have a kind of a strange situation that we've never faced before. And our young players come into our practice facility and train individually with coaches. Our veteran players are scattered about, there's really nothing formal happening right now. We're trying to prepare for next year without really any kind of blueprint for how to do it.
Well, and it looks like the league may not start until potentially March, right? If in fact they think that fans will be able to come then, how do you keep the team together? I mean, just emotionally and all that. I mean, this is a bizarre sort of off-season kind of situation.
Yeah, we had a few virtual calls early on, and then a lot of phone calls in between, and then, go into the facility and maybe half the guys are in the facility, in our practice facility in the mornings. Most of our young guys are in there. And so, you kind of end up randomly, seeing guys or touching base with them via phone or email, text. But it's not the same. We're used to being together as a group and doing everything together as a team. So we're just, plugging away, doing our thing and hoping that there's some kind of a a clear view of what next season will look like before too long.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like for families, this is hard, right? Staying connected during this time. I mean, one of the reasons that we wanted to bring you on the show, obviously, is that you have been very outspoken about politics. You have a deep personal history, and we want to get into some of that in a bit. But I'm curious, baseball pitcher Sean Doolittle recently talked about whether to bring back sports at all, saying that sports are the reward of a functioning society. And we've had conversations about like whether some of the protests that happened would have happened if we had all been distracted by sports or concerts. What's your view on that? Like, do you think that there's been a sort of political upside to this, at least the break at first?
I do think that a lot of the protest and a lot of the movement has happened because of the quarantine, because of the suspension of life. We can't get wrapped up in our daily routines like we always have, you know? So, you know, when you sort of look back at the last decade, and there's been so many instances that you think would have put us over the top, in some form or fashion, if you want to talk about racial violence, you know, Trayvon Martin, that could have happened. You know, we could have tipped the scales years ago with Trayvon Martin and many others. Gun violence in general. I mean, Sandy Hook happened, 7-8 years ago. You know, how did that not tip the scales to where we all didn't just stop and say, wait a second? Somebody walked in and machine gunned down a bunch of kindergartners. That didn't stop us. And so I think because of COVID, because of the suspension, none of us were able to just sort of turn the other way and get back into our routines and do what human beings do, which is kind of return to your comforts and return to your family and friends and your job, and you just immerse yourself in whatever you're doing. And because of that, we've been opening our eyes up more and been called to action, I guess.
We have seen the different leagues, pro sports leagues, deal with these kinds of things very differently. The NFL, of course, was not hospitable, did not embrace Colin Kaepernick when he kneeled during the national anthem. He hasn't been able to get a contract with a team. And yet we've seen the NBA, you, LeBron James, Greg Popovich, several Warriors, including, you know, Steph Curry and the Warrior management, really outspoken in support of this racial justice movement. What do you think accounts for the difference in, you know, the leagues, and especially, you know, why the NBA? Why has the NBA embraced this the way it has?
Well, I think the NBA has always had great support from the league management. Right now from Adam Silver, but before that from David Stern, commissioner. The league has always been supportive and felt like a partner when it comes to social issues and protest. And so in the past, you know, anytime players or coaches have wanted to speak out about anything, it came from a place of comfort. We didn't worry about, losing our job or being reprimanded. We felt supported. And I think that's been really helpful for all of us. And now you're seeing it. I think the league players, the league itself, the broadcast partners have really done a beautiful job of presenting these broadcasts. I don't know if you guys have seen any of these tributes, but some of the opens to the telecast have been beautifully done and are really powerful. They're speaking really positive messages to the public, so it's inspiring.
You know, but if you think back to, you know, we mentioned, Marisa mentioned The Last Dance, you know, the Bulls, the team that you were part of. I mean, Michael Jordan was, you know, very apolitical for whatever set of reasons. I mean, is there something in the players themselves that you think has evolved?
Yeah, the generational. The point, yeah.
Generational or other, we do see people like the very top stars like LeBron and Steph Curry speaking out.
I think it's generational. I think it's a sign of the times. I think in the 90s, rarely did an athlete speak out. But it was also a time of relative innocence, you know, and that's not to say that bad things weren't happening. But we didn't have social media, so we weren't being bombarded with all the bad news all day long. It was pre-9/11, so our country wasn't so divided. There was a much better sense of well-being, I think, as a country in the 90s. So even though there were opportunities to speak out, athletes in general didn't really say much. And I think that was the general climate in the country, too. You just had a sense that things were healthier and it was easier to just go about your day. That may have been a matter of us all sort of being a little bit blinded by the times, too, because obviously, you know, there were plenty of bad things happening, but it was just a different era. And now people feel compelled to speak because the times are calling for it.
How do you think about when and how to speak out? I know last year you were asked about what was happening in Hong Kong and expressed some regret later that you hadn't been more supportive of the Houston Rockets general manager, but you've been very upfront on gun control and other issues. Do you weigh, I don't know, what you think you have more expertise in, or just think about your own life experience and what kind of what moves you?
Yeah, I try to stick with what moves me. And you know, I lost my dad to gun violence when I was 18. He was 52. That issue has been something that I've been very passionate about for a long time. And I want to say about 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, was the first time I spoke openly and publicly about it. And that was the first time I really said much of anything politically or publicly. And that sort of opened the door, I guess. I've realized over time that once you go down that path, you're going to be put in some uncomfortable situations and you have to be ready for everything. And you mentioned the Hong Kong issue last year. That was a really, really uncomfortable position to be in because China has been a partner in the NBA and obviously across America with thousands of companies. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, you know, when the human rights issues are really being exposed, and you're asked about it and you're part of the NBA, it's like, oh, wait a second. And I was sort of deer in the headlights, you know, when I was asked about it. And I think it caught a lot of us by surprise, and I handled it horribly. I regret my answer to this day. I sort of, you know, gave it no comment and then said something else. And it was really embarrassing. But that's part of the deal. When you're in the public eye and you choose to speak out, you have to take that. You have to understand that you got to be ready, and you're going to screw up sometimes. And we all do.
All right. Well, we never do, but, you know, sometimes others do. All right. Well, you mentioned your dad. We're going to come back in a moment and talk about him. We're going to take a short break right now. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Golden State Warriors head coach Steve Kerr. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. Happy holidays, everybody.
Today we're revisiting our interview from August with Golden State Warriors head coach Steve Kerr.
And Kerr had a lot to say about his life and career, his growing political voice, and how he talked about politics and racial justice with his players.
The week we spoke with Kerr, the city of Beirut in Lebanon was in the news. There had been a terrible explosion that killed more than 200 people, the causes of which are still unclear.
And Beirut is where Kerr was born, where he spent much of his childhood, and where his dad was tragically assassinated in 1984. So we asked him what it was like to see the city back in the headlines.
Well, they were horrifying images. You know, they looked like a nuclear bomb went off. And, you know, we have family friends there. My mom is still very close with people who work at the university. Fortunately, it was far enough away from the university that there wasn't major damage. But she told me that some doors were blown off the hinges on campus. As I said, the campus was pretty far from the explosion, but, you know, Beirut is already in the midst of a horrible humanitarian crisis. The economy is a disaster. People are struggling already. And so this was just brutal to happen on top of all that. So it makes me very sad. As you said, that's my birthplace, and we have a lot of family history there.
Yeah, I was really struck because my mother's side is Armenian, by your grandparents' history in the Middle East. They got on a boat, I think, and met there, sailed over across the world, I think, in 1919, and are credited with helping save, I think, like 10,000 orphans that had fled Armenia from the Turks. Was that a story, a reality that you grew up knowing or understanding?
We grew up knowing it. I don't know that we understood it. My grandfather wrote a book about it. And you know, they were very modest people, so they never really spoke much about it. But you know, we learned about it. When you're young, you sort of just assume everything is normal. You know, grandma and grandpa just, you know, they went overseas somewhere and ran an orphanage and saved a bunch of people. Like everybody does that, I guess, you know. It's been amazing, though, over the years. I can't tell you how many people of Armenian descent have come up to me at arenas all over the NBA and waving Armenian flags you know, just waving me down and telling me, thanking me for my grandparents' service, and even saying, you know, I wouldn't be alive right now if it weren't for your grandparents. Wow. It's incredible to hear these stories. And so it's something that my family and I are all obviously incredibly proud of.
Yeah.
You, as you said, you were born in Beirut. You spent some of your childhood there. You also spent time, I think, kindergarten in France. You went to junior high in Egypt, Cairo, Egypt. Did you think of yourself? I mean, what did being an American mean to you, being such an international kind of kid?
Well, I think at the time, you know, when you're young, you kind of just want to be with your pals. And so I was always mad every time we went overseas. You know, I wanted to stay in Los Angeles, which was our home base, and just live my normal life. But I realized later on, it was the education of a lifetime to be able to go overseas and live in different cultures and go to international schools and meet people from all over the world. And it really shaped my entire worldview for sure. So I was really, really fortunate to have that childhood and to be able to experience the things that I have.
I mean, it's an interesting contrast, right? On the one hand, you're like a basketball obsessed kid. On the other hand, you're jet setting around to international schools. And you mentioned your dad earlier. I want to talk a little bit about his impact on your life, because it seems like, from whatever I've read, he was a real pacifist. He really believed in the ability of people to find peace. I don't know. Were those conversations that you felt like you were having growing up, or just sort of absorbing as part of that family?
I think I was absorbing more than anything. You know, I was kind of the black sheep, being the dumb jock of the family. You know, I had my older two siblings, both went on and got PhDs, one from Stanford, one from Harvard.
There was a story about your mom introducing her kids and saying that we have two PhDs, an MBA and an NBA in the family.
That's right. I was the anti-intellectual one in the group, but I was always obsessed with sports. But I always was at the dinner table listening to the conversation, and so we always had so many interesting people around. My mom and dad liked to have barbecues in our backyard. My dad was a professor at UCLA, and he had a lot of colleagues who would come over, students. And we'd hear all kinds of different languages and meet people from all over. And my dad, most of what I remember was talk of the Middle East peace situation, because that was his passion. He was a professor of Middle East history and politics. So I remember, for example, when Begin and Sadat and Jimmy Carter shook hands on the lawn of the White House and signed the Camp David Accords. And that was like the greatest moment of my dad's life. I mean, that's what he had been dreaming of for so long. And so I have so many memories like that of watching the evening news and hearing about what was going on in the Middle East, and then hearing my dad and my mom comment on it and discuss what was happening. And I just listened, really.
Before you graduated from high school, I think your dad went to American University in Beirut, and his predecessor had been to be president, and the predecessor had been kidnapped. How worried were you about him, and what were you, as a kid, what was your family told about the risks that he was facing going over there in this moment of such, war, really?
Yeah, I think we all sort of have a false sense of security to us, until something actually happens. You never really believe something's going to happen to you, even in the face of danger. Sometimes we just ignore global pandemics and things like that. You just sort of keep living your life, and you don't really stop and think too much. And that job was my dad's dream job. It had been his dream job since he had been a grad student at the university there. He grew up on the campus in Beirut. And so when the job was offered to him to replace the president, and the acting president was kidnapped, we're all sitting there like, well, what does this mean? There had been multiple faculty members that had been kidnapped. And our dad assured us he was going to be fine. And again, it's just, you look back and now you think, what were we doing? Like, what could we possibly have been thinking? As I said, it was his dream job, and he felt good enough about the political situation. When he took the job, he spent a year in New York and let the political situation die down in Beirut until he felt safe, until the university felt safe enough for him to go over there. Mm-hmm. And so everybody thought that he'd be safe, but obviously he was not.
I mean, I know you were already well on the path with basketball at that point. You were figuring out where to go to, or you were at Arizona State, I guess. University of Arizona. I'm sorry, not Arizona State.
Yeah, we don't, just to be clear, we don't like Arizona State.
got it. Yeah, right. So you were already in college, you were pursuing basketball, but I wonder, is that a reason that you didn't get political until later? Do you feel like your dad's story and the grief and trauma from that made you want to just really focus on the game instead of all this other stuff?
Yeah, I think so. And I wasn't confident enough to say anything. I could barely give an interview at 18, I marvel at these guys today who come into the NBA at 18 or 19 and are constantly giving press conferences and doing really well. I remember at 18 stammering through my first interview on campus. And so, at the time, that was the furthest thing from my mind, was discussing politically. But you know, like most college students, I was really interested in what I was doing and focused on that. And I really didn't become heavily interested, and I didn't really start reading about world events and world politics extensively until later on in my life. And that's when I became much more involved.
I'm wondering, you know, we're going to skip ahead a bit because we don't have a ton of time here. You had an extraordinary career and run with a number of teams, including, of course, the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan. Watch The Last Dance if you haven't seen it. It's a terrific series. And then you come to the Warriors in 2014, 2015, and took over from Mark Jackson, the coach, and the Splash Brothers were here. And I'm just wondering, you know, what have you learned from the players that you've been around about politics, about the experience of being Black in this country, and the kinds of issues that you're now on the front lines of talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And you know, one of the things that I felt really strongly about was that the best learning environments are those where everybody has a voice, you know, and discussion is really prominent. And I really wanted to open things up and for our players to be comfortable and confident speaking about anything, whether it was basketball or anything else. And so I tried to establish that early with our staff. You know, I think it took a little bit of time. You know, you have to get to know one another really well before people, I think, feel really confident and comfortable discussing matters of race and social division. But these last few years have been amazing. Some of our players who I've connected with have taught me so much. I mean, Andre Iguodala and David West are, the two of them in particular, are really well-read on African-American history. And so they've taught me, you know, I feel like my education taught me a lot of the good in Black American history, the achievements. And those two guys taught me a lot of the things that have been covered up, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget Andre Iguodala a couple of years ago saying, Coach, you ever heard of Black Wall Street? I said, no, I've never heard of Black Wall Street. He said, look it up and we'll talk about it tomorrow. And I came in the next day and I was blown away, and we talked about it. And I had no idea that this whole Black community existed in Tulsa and was thriving and economically supporting one another, and then just was burned to the ground and 300 people were murdered. How are we not taught that, you know, in American history class? And David West, same, like incredibly well-read. And we've had some great conversations about politics and who the Black community should be supporting in his view to be president. I'm not talking about between Trump and Biden. I think
that train's left.
But I mean, between Biden and the other Democratic candidates while that was going on. And that was fascinating to me, because it was, you know, it came from a completely different angle than the way that me as a 54-year-old white guy thinking about it.
So, yeah. Well, you can hear the music, and that means only one thing. It's not good. We're out of time. But Coach Kerr, thank you so much. Good luck with whatever comes next. We hope it's good things for you and the Warriors.
Guys, thanks for having me on.
You bet. That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineers, Katie McMurrin. KQED's leadership team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Jonathan Blakely, and Erica Aguilar. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. Stay safe, everybody.